So today's panel is called Intent and Impact, How Visualization Can Make a Change. First, a little bit of housekeeping. Please make sure to shut your iPhones off. We will have a Q&A session at the end, so push your questions back to the end, and then we can address all your individual questions. There is a hashtag for this session, which is called VisImpact, so use that if you want to tweet about us. So what we will do today, we will collect some ideas, some thoughts, and some inspiration from an excellent selection of experts about how you can apply visualization to create change. We will do this on different scales, and that's why I've invited these excellent speakers to address the topic on multiple scales. So first up, we have Moritz Stefaner. He is a truth and beauty operator working out of Germany. I think his track record gives him right to call himself like that. So he has worked on beautiful interactive applications for the OECD, the World Economic Forum, the Max Planck Institute, and among others. He will address the topic of visualization and how we can make a change on the level of data and the insights that we find in it. Next up is Leslie Bradshaw. Leslie Bradshaw is president and COO of Chess3. And if you haven't seen any posters by Chess3 by now, you're not at South by Southwest. She will address the topic on the scale of information and communication of the insights that we found in the data. Next up is Tal Siach. Tal Siach represents Visually. He replaces Adam Breckler. He couldn't be here because he probably have coded for the last 3 days straight to make happen what you have seen today on Visually. He will talk a little bit about that. He will address the topic on the level of tools and platforms to make change happen. And I'm very thrilled to have Adam Bly. Adam Bly is the founder and CEO of the Seed Media Group and of Visualizing.org. Visualizing.org is also a platform to discover, share, and promote visualizations. They do an awesome job at that. Thanks so much. He will address the topic from a bird's eye perspective and see what change on society can be done with data visualization. I am Benjamin Wiederkehr. Together with Moritz, I represent the exotic dialects from European people. I work for a company that's called Interactive Things. We do data visualization and user experience design, and I'm happy to host this panel for you today. So these are the experts. They will give short presentations on their own, addressing the topic from their perspective. If you like what they say, please give them a hand after their individual presentations. But I will start off with a little bit of background, a little bit of context, because when I say change, it's really important that we have in our mind that change means 1,000 different things to 1,000 different people. And so the question is, like, what change do you want to make? Is it you want to inform people and increase their knowledge? Is it you want to convince people and shape their opinions? Or is it you want to nudge people in a certain direction and change their behavior? And so, just to give you an example of the differences between these goals and how to achieve them, this is one project by GE about the energy consumption. And what we see right here is an interactive application that represents the energy consumption for multiple household appliances and the energy usage that they represent. This is a really informative visualization, so it requires the user to get information out of it. He will be informed after he experienced and after he has interacted with the visualization, but he may not have changed his behavior. Another project, it's called Tidy Street Project, addresses this topic of energy consumption on a completely different level. So what they do is they have asked the neighborhood to participate in this project, and they will plot out the energy consumption of all the households right on the street. So as you go along, you will see the energy consumption of a full week of all the people. And the data is updated overnight. So there's a direct feedback loop between what people use, so their behavior, and the data that is shown on the street. With this, after 1 week, they were able to decrease the energy consumption by 15%. So the metrics on how we evaluate these visualizations or these projects are completely different. So for me, it's important to understand you have an intent with your visualizations and you have an impact with your visualizations, which should correlate. And back to the regular scheduled program, and I hand over to Moritz Stefaner.
Hi, guys. I'll just say hi while the machine hopefully will soon show the picture. There we are. Hi, everyone. Thanks, Benjamin, for putting together this round. It's great to be here. My name is Moritz Stefaner, and as Benjamin said already, I work as a truth and beauty operator. So I'm a practicing information visualization guy. And, well, what is so fascinating about data visualization? And to me, it's really this notion of seeing the world from above. And these are images stitched together from the ISS space station. It's individual photos. And when I saw that, I had to think of that notion that when the first astronauts came back from space, they said, like, seeing the world from above changed totally how they thought about our planet. And the fascinating thing is, and the unique position we're in today, is that we can see all kinds of worlds from this perspective. You know, you can see the world of knowledge, the world of social relationships, your personal life. In principle, data visualization can enable us to see all these worlds from above and have that these insights and that sense of awe that comes with these bird's eye perspectives. And for me, visualization is not about making things simple. It's about making the complex comprehensible, really, and accessible, but not, let's say, dumbing it down to a simple formula. So I do commissioned projects. I'll just show you a brief overview so you have a sense of what I'm up to. So this is an installation I did for Max Planck Society. It's a large research institution running different institutes. And this multi-touch installation shows how these collaborate. So, and how they collaborate with external partners. So you can look at one institute and see exactly, they write a lot of papers together with MIT and a few with Caltech. On the other hand, you can also just go to Britain on the world map and see which Max Planck Institute work with partners from the UK, things like that. This is Notabilia. It's a visualization of deletion discussions on Wikipedia. And so each branch here represents one discussion, if a certain page should be kept or deleted. So you can learn how the discussion went for unusual sex acts or the page related to the list of similarities between Canada and New Zealand, which was more controversial than the unusual sex act one, in fact. This is a muesli ingredient network, which muesli ingredients are used together. But I also do more, let's say, more sober and serious stuff in my work for the World Economic Forum. So I do the information graphics for some of their reports. As I said, to me, data visualization is a lot about embracing complexity and enabling people to really deal with complexity and complex interrelationships. Coming back to our topic, intent, impact, this is a lot related, for me at least, it's two presentations in one, I'm sorry, because I had like two really main points I wanted to bring across, so somehow I hope I'll pull it off. So, but one really important point is talking about workflows. Like, when you have a goal, how do you reach it, right? And usually when clients come to me, I tell them two things I will need from them. One, why are we doing this? What do you want to achieve with that? And this can be a rough idea in the beginning. You don't have to like have your goals already set out like in a bullet list or whatever. But it's good to start that discussion early, like what do you hope to achieve really? And the second thing is that I say is I need some data. we can have a meeting to discuss, but until I get really start to work, I will need some data and some real data. And the reason for that is there's an important feedback loop. In my experience, you need to explore your data sets really early and in many ways. So as Hans Rosling said, you need to let the data change your mindset, your data set change your mindset, right? So, and if you don't give the data the chance to change your own opinion, why should it change your recipient's opinion? You know, if you know beforehand what you want exactly and how it should look like, why use data at all? So that's the first point. Let your data set during development really change the course of the project, redefine the strategy and the goals. So we have a lot of iterations back and forth with prototypes, and then we narrow it down a bit to one solution, and we have a finished product. But then things shouldn't stop, of course. So, and I have to admit, I'm really notoriously bad also at this point. But optimally, in a great project, you would watch people use your product and establish a second feedback loop where the users now and the usage of the visualization feeds back into a second iteration or into your next project, or at least in some reflection and analysis of what works and what doesn't, right? And I'll show you one project where we sort of, where we at least started to really establish these two feedback loops. And this was a commission by the OECD, and they wanted to do a new country ranking or a new way of looking at different countries, a bit like the Human Development Index that was mentioned also in the panel before. And the idea is to look at countries beyond like income and jobs and housing, but also look at life satisfaction, at health, and more subjective measures. And so they approached me to come up with a good visualization form for that. And this is, in short, the project we ended up with. And I found that very interesting because the OECD already came with that idea of, okay, we need to do something a bit more unusual because we also want to transport the idea that we as an institution think beyond bar charts or think beyond hard numbers or think beyond this institutionalized view. So if even the OECD comes with these ideas, I think that shows that things are changing a bit. And now here comes the detour because this is now topic number two. But I think this is sort of the overarching topic too, that we have whole new goals for visualization that we don't even understand. So traditionally, you say a visualization is a tool and it's made for analysis and it's made for, or maybe an infographic is made for explaining something. But now we are moving in these much more fuzzy areas of data visualizations being used for communication, for branding, for entertainment maybe. Or what I hear really often is this, we need to raise awareness for, which is like a totally fuzzy goal and really hard to evaluate if you think about it. But it's okay, I think. I don't think that's a bad thing. And so we have this whole new world where information visualization can play a role. And for me, I sort of collect all that under the term cultural artifact. So I like to think of visualization more in terms of comparable to movies or to books or to music, maybe in some use cases. And also maybe for your mindset, what does that mean for the evaluation of a visualization if it's more a cultural object? Some quick pointers in this idea, in this direction. So I was commissioned to do a remix of Hans Rosling's work, a remixed visualization. I mean, I think that already shows that there's something like pop cultural going on in this field. We have companies like Bloom also doing pop cultural instruments, using playful visualizations to deal with data, data games, if you will. We have people like Golan Levin, who is incredibly creative, of course, and he does, for instance, like street art stencil toolkits, so you can spray custom bar charts in your neighborhood or pie charts. And of course, we have the Feltron annual reports, where he gives them, like a bank or so, an annual report, but on his personal activities with a very interesting visual language. So we have all these new ways of dealing with InfoWiz, and I think that also means we have to look at the qualities, what makes a good InfoWiz in different ways. And detour, coming back to the project. So the solution we came up with is one where we had each country represented by a flower, and now the user could pick different weights depending on what he or she thinks is important. So if you prioritize Luxembourg, If you prioritize income or housing or more material measures, Luxembourg will rise to the top. But these are really bad at governance. For instance, if you put more weight on governance and life satisfaction and health, then the northern countries like Sweden, Denmark, and Australia also, and so on, move more to the top. So it's a whole new way. It's not the way of comparing countries, but every user can sort of create his own ranking of the data. And these personalized views are really important. Talking about the iterations, so we had a lot of design iterations in coming up with that solution. So it looks like it might look like just an idea, but in fact we tried a lot of ideas and we also tried them with real data. And in the end, the decision was made really for something that works from a communication point of view, but also from the data visualization point of view. And the other thing is, what we are doing now is behind the scenes analyze how people use that tool. So the obvious thing is, of course, you do page view tracking and these types of things. What we also did is we established sort of an event system where we would see exactly which types of button clicks people would do at which times. But the most interesting thing is, of course, how often has each rating been assigned to each topic, or how are the topics treated differently, right? Because for the OECD, this is the actual back channel where they can see of what people are actually interested in from a content point of view, not just if the button is at the right position. And this is the interesting part, really. And we learned quite a lot there. So there are some interesting, some obvious insights. The most popular topics were education, health, life satisfaction. Governance is quite unpopular. I think the name is just bad. So if you work with these short labels, the naming is really crucial. The one star rating gets very little, in the end, very little clicks, or it appears very rarely, which is totally strange because it's the default. So what we expected is that people would like click one or two of these ratings and then leave the rest at one. But that didn't happen. If you look to the right hand side, all of the 3, 4, 5 star ratings are used very often. That means people use the highest ratings very often. And these are all things we didn't really expect. In addition, we also have a little survey so we can do some user demographics. So what we, in the end, we are after is like, do, let's say, French women think about the world different than Finnish men, possibly, and these types of things. And I can't go into detail, really. The big problem we have, if you, for instance, look at gender differences or so, there is no big difference. And this comes exactly from the problem that I mentioned earlier. The ratings are so high, in general, that the signal gets lost. So sorry, I'm throwing a lot of charts at you at the moment, but the what came out for us is that the most popular combination is to have like 5 stars on everything, or the second one was 5 star for one of the dimensions and then 1 for the rest. And this was very frustrating, and we didn't expect it at all. So now in the next iteration, we will improve the rating mechanism to maybe enforce or to encourage a bit more controversial positive negative rating instead of just assigning, let's say, the iTunes stars. But all these things you can only figure out if you watch people use your tool for a while. And so this is why the second feedback loop, I think, is really important. We learned a lot, and now we have the chance also to do that second iteration that it needs. So these are the two take-home things. The two feedback loops, I think they're really important. And think about what that means. I don't know what that means with the cultural artifacts, but I think it's big. So thanks.
So while they're getting the computer set up, I just want to do a quick show of hands. How many people in this room would be intimidated to go after someone who is from Germany talking about data? Okay, a few people? All right, well, I'm going to keep my hand up. I'm actually from Nevada, and my folks came across the Oregon Trail 6 generations ago. And I grew up in Northern California and in Oregon and spent a lot of time on the farm. And I loved science, and I loved math as a little girl. And when I eventually went to choose my university, I chose the University of Chicago. And we like to talk about University of Chicago as where fun comes to die. And that has a lot to do with the curriculum, the amount of work. And truth be told, it's actually all the nerds don't want anyone else to come there who doesn't also like math and other fun, cool things like that. So my background is more along the social sciences. I do look at, when we talk about impact, I look at how people's behaviors and minds do change. And I've had the privilege and honor to co-found a company called Jess3. The other part, or the Jess in the Jess3, is my partner in life and in business. And he's an incredible UX designer and really had the vision early on to be data-driven. And our website, Jess3.com, you'll see we're a creative agency that specializes in data visualization. And what we've done there is we've broken through the noise of a lot of other creative agencies who are talking about storytelling and social media. And we said, you know what, we're going to pick data. And over the last 6 years, we've evolved to more broadly tell stories. But whenever we can, we always look at how can we take data to impact that conversation. I think even to some of Moritz's points about that feedback loop is how can we also use the analytics and the insights to drive the next variation of content. I'm going to start actually with a couple pieces of content that have two very different goals in the mind, right? We talk about the objectives, and I'll talk a little bit about the impact they've had. The first piece we actually made for ESPN, and their research department came to us, and we were just so excited because we're geeking out about it. We kind of like sports, we love data, and they said, we've got a problem. We need to educate all of the folks at ESPN on the Nielsen TV ratings and how that all works. And right now we've got a disconnect between our advertisers, our marketers, people that are on-air talent and producers. And that's really, the Nielsen ratings are like the Google Analytics of TV. And they needed more people to understand that concept. And what they were doing is actually doing a bit of a roadshow. They had a nice PowerPoint deck that was designed in PowerPoint. Big no-no. It's supposed to only deliver in PowerPoint. So they designed something in PowerPoint and they had to go to office and everybody was required to sit for 60 minutes through TV ratings 101. Now I'll do another show of hands. How many people would look forward to going to something like that? Look at that, no hands were raised. So what was great about the client is that they really wanted to use data, storytelling, and entertainment to do something that they wanted everyone to get excited about. And we almost kind of, we called it the internal viral effect is what we wanted to have happen. It really didn't care if it went out on the web, but we needed people to watch it, to learn it, to love it, to know it, and to apply that approach to all of their future collaborations with their teams, with their advertisers, with their content partners. So I'm going to go ahead and show you the final product. It's 6 minutes, so I'm not going to show the whole thing, but I'm going to show just the initial part, and hopefully what you'll see is how we approach the project and hopefully learn a thing or two. Do we have sound? Kind of important. User error, excuse me. Is that plugged in?
There is audio on this.
I'm so sorry. Sorry about that. Everybody, Colin. Thank you, Colin. Thank you so much, Colin.
Good evening, and welcome to the latest installment of Rating Center. I'm Chip Spaulding, alongside Clay Rogers here to cover the finer points of TV ratings. What do you say, Clay?
Well, Chip, it turns out our viewers have been tweeting up a storm. Everybody wants to know how the rating system works. Since we here at Rating Center consider ourselves the ratings experts, we feel it our humble obligation to give the people what they want. First, to size our audience, we turn to Nielsen. To estimate TV audiences, Nielsen starts by creating a sample that accurately reflects the population. They employ a random sample where all homes have an equal chance of being selected. This ensures that the sample mirrors the population according to gender, age, geography, race, cable status, and other characteristics.
So, say 49% of the population is male. Does that mean 49% of Nielsen's random sample is also male?
Well said, Chip. And all under 140 characters. Totes tweet-worthy.
Holy Holy fastball, folks. I've just gotten word that a Nielsen correspondent is on her way to install a meter in an actual household. Let's go there live.
Thanks, Chip. I'm about to place a meter that monitors usage on every TV, DVR, DVD, and game console in the home. Like a dog whistle that only the meter can hear, audio codes embedded in TV content identify the network, date, and timestamp. The Nielsen sample consists of homes that agreed to participate for up to 2 years. The meters have remotes pre-programmed with each household's member's info. They log in when they start watching TV and log out when they're done. That data is then sent back to Nielsen each night to be processed.
Wow, looks like networks and advertisers really know their key audiences. You mentioned DVRs. How do those factor in, Chip?
Funny you should ask, Clay. I actually majored in statistics.
Oh, really?
Yes, really. To get the most accurate ratings, you have to look at all viewing behaviors. Not only do you consider those who watch live, but also live plus same day and live plus 7 days. What are you doing over there, Clay?
I'm tuning in so I can watch us live. I need to check out my sexy stash on screen.
Oh, totally sexy. I always just set my DVR to record us and study my Don Johnson stare at night when I get home. That reminds me, I need to set my DVR to record Real Housewives of Bristol while I'm on vacay for the rest of the week. That's the first thing I'll watch when I get home at the end of the week.
Hey, so to recap, boys and girls, live viewing means you watch the program as it was happening. Live plus same day viewing means you either watched it live or watched it from your DVR within the same day. Live plus 7 viewing means you either watched it live or watched it from your DVR within 7 days of when it aired.
Thanks, Clay. Well, we've reached that time in our program where we perform our ratings formula. For that, let's go to expert number cruncher Baxter Orion.
Thank you, Chip. Nielsen has gathered the data from the meters to project the number of homes or viewers watching in the entire population. This is known as impressions. Additionally, each cable network has a total number of subscribers, possibly watching a program, known as its universe. When we take the number of impressions and divide it by the universe, we get a percentage, which is our cable coverage rating. Now, let's say two different cable networks had 25 million people watching in prime time. One network had 100 million subscribers, while the other had 50 million subscribers. Putting this in our formula, we get... Oh! The first network delivered a 25.0 coverage rating, and the other delivered a 50.0 coverage rating.
Exactly, because the first network's universe is double the latter. It's also important to remember that a rating is an average minute statistic. So, let's say the monster truck rally earned a 25.0 rating. Then 25% of cable network subscribers were watching during the average minute of that telecast.
Oh, and what about commercial?
So, with that piece, what we did was create something that was useful, beautiful, and entertaining. And if there are any brands in the audience that are looking to use data visualization to help tell their personal story or even to do better education internally, those three components are incredibly critical. We also wrote it with a lot of things in mind, like the Real Housewives of Bristol. Bristol, Connecticut is where ESPN's based. So there's a lot of things that you can kind of play on with the audience, and you can be really extra quirky. So what we did was include the 1979 soundtrack from SportsCenter. So there were certain things that we kind of hooked, knowing our target audience were the employees of ESPN. It also happened to go viral on the internet. Lots of other people picked it up, but our impact and our goal was to take the control group, which was probably about 10% full understanding and comprehension of the TV ratings, and bring it up to as close to 100% as possible. The video was released a few months ago, and we're continuing to measure against that. But so far, what we've had is it wasn't that you had to go into this room and be taught TV ratings 101, but people were starting to shoot the video around and say, have you seen this yet? Have you seen it? Have you seen it? And that's what you want to do. You want to create a viral effect out of the content that you're trying to communicate through. And it doesn't necessarily always have to be, let's get an infographic together and let's put it on Mashable. I mean, that's not always going to reach every objective, but it doesn't mean you're going to also not think through how data might drive your overall story. I'm going to show you a completely different story that we're working on telling right now as a company, a little more serious. We're talking a lot about the elections, and we're working right now with Google, and they're looking at how do we tell the story of a company who has Americans and all over the world, but Americans searching for the candidate they want to vote for. And not only is that search something that can be pinpointed down to the geo level, but it's also something that you could start seeing. Are there correlations with polls, exit polls, polls going into it? Are there correlations with the actual results? And this is an incredible project that Google's undertaken, and we're really proud to be a part of the effort. But we're starting to look at the correlations. In this case, after Super Tuesday, we looked at all states. We looked at the states that were won, what the Google search results were in the 3 days leading up to those states as people were deciding on who they'd vote for, how many delegates were won, and also what were the national polls saying. In the end, in the footnote, you'll see, you know, our sources are Gallup and New York Times, CNN, and also Google. So if you kind of look at the search for the candidate overall, how do you present that complex amount of information? And how do you put it forth in a way that's discernible and digestible? And some of this content actually, you know, you have to think about what's the end point. For infographics on the web, there's a lot of constraints, and you can think about the size and shape, and then you put it on broadcast and the partners like MSNBC and Fox, and it has to be really simplified. So breaking out individual pieces of this graphic would be how you'd approach it. But in this case, we're able to look at Alaska and Georgia and see, you know, in some cases, the candidates that ended up winning were the ones who had the highest volume of search around the time. And actually 6 out of 10 states, the candidates that won also were the most searched for candidates in that state. Some other interesting things. There was a piece in the Washington Post about 2 weeks ago from George Will, famed conservative columnist. And he talked about saying, let's forget the presidential race. We've already lost. If you're a Republican, if you're a conservative, we've already lost. We need to start focusing on the Senate and the House. And if you look at search data and overall volume for national search candidates, the 4 lines below the bright blue line are all the Republican candidates. And the bright blue line is Obama. So when you think about the overall interest of what folks have, it's Obama, right? You know, he's outranking other folks. And if that does correlate to end results, as we've seen in some of the Super Tuesday results, it's kind of an interesting indicator early on, kind of early on warning system. So both cases, I showed you Google, I showed you ESPN. And when I think about branded content, I think a lot about what clients and what brands are trying to do. And they're really trying to impact conversation. And I think we've already talked about, is it that they want to impact conversation to drive a new action, to drive a conversion or a sale or a donation? But no matter what you're doing, you're actually trying to impact the knowledge that drives that conversation. And the great thing about data visualization is that it can get upstream. So if downstream is the conversation, imparting and impacting the knowledge on the conversation before it even gets there is incredibly powerful. So I'm going to switch over just to a few slides. I've also put it up on SlideShare/Jess3 in the event that I won't get to all the little bits and pieces. It's not my computer, so I've got different settings. I'm so sorry. Not even the German can do it, so I don't feel so bad. They're good at timepieces and technology. Thank you. Yeah, the Swiss. Yeah,
yeah,
there we go.
Swiss ones.
Yay.
Thanks, Switzerland.
Welcome. So we want to drive conversation because we know that conversation can turn into that awareness and then the opinions, and eventually, really what we want is a lot of advocates, because advocates, they can bring for a brand new friends, and they can reinforce and kind of carry the water of that brand. And as we know with conversations, we can't control those conversations because we're human beings. And it's not just that Web 2.0 taught us that it's a two-way dialogue. It's that humanity taught us that. And when you think about wanting to impact that, you know, going back to what I was noting earlier, in order to impact it, you must shape the knowledge that defines it. And that's where data visualization, when you're thinking about, does it make sense for our objectives? If you're trying to impact that conversation and you have knowledge to help drive it, that's incredibly important. Now, the old model in branding, and it still exists today, is that we really pummel consumers with impressions until they submit. 6 impressions and some conversion is supposed to happen. Maybe we hit them on a billboard. Maybe we hit them with an advertisement. And finally, they say, I give up. Fine. I'll buy your chips or your diapers or your peanut butter. But the new model, as people can start consuming consuming all of the information that they have available, you start being able to compare on Yelp which restaurant you want to go to, or you start seeing ratings and rankings, and you're starting to get this data feedback loop as a consumer, and you're starting to make your decisions driven based on data, and you're making your banking decisions based on the kind of analytics dashboard that your banks and credit cards are now giving you. So this new model has this education and empowerment in mind. And that's incredibly powerful with data visualization, because the clear and concise presentation of that information can actually impact the volume and the sentiment and the tenor of those conversations. And that's something that we've observed through a number of the projects that we've done. And I'm going to give you just three tips that if you're a brand and you're thinking about getting into data visualization, or maybe you're already there and it's not quite working for you. When you think about data visualization, think about trying to create and kind of associate yourself with a larger narrative. Salesforce, they wanted to own the cloud. It wasn't just that they wanted to talk about their tool, but they wanted to talk about the impact of the cloud. And they told the story of the state of cloud computing. They were a character in that 60-year plot, but they were not the star. As a result, the SEO and the benefit and the value that they got out of it was incredible. Now, visualizations can also leverage the zeitgeist. Moments that are happening and bursting at any given time, whether it be Occupy Wall Street or the elections, or in the case of Wikipedia and their 10-year anniversary. We're even leveraging the zeitgeist right now. The Just 3 team is curating in real time a visualization with Samsung, and we're helping them get the news that maybe Mashable is going to be acquired by CNN, and we're catching all of the volume of that sentiment, and we're pushing it up live onto the screen. We're looking where people are. And that is an opportunity for a brand to help tell a larger story, not necessarily be the star, but be a character. And last but not least, the visualizations can bring value to a targeted community. I think the ESPN piece was a great example of the ESPN community as that target. But we've also done a lot of other kind of nerdy stuff. The Content Grid was a B2B content marketing best practices. If you're trying to get a certain customer acquisition, what should I do? And people print these out and put them in their cubicles, and they love it. And it's really incredibly helpful. So before I turn it over, the last thing I want to end on, while all of these things can be done, the most important things that we've found to include in our visualizations, just because they're for a brand, doesn't mean that you still don't approach it with that level of integrity. Make sure that there's something useful for the end user. And also make sure that there's this high expression of craft, whether it's the data analysts, the ones that are laying out the blueprint, or even the graphic designers, and making sure to even promote it out so that people can pick up and learn and dig in on that graphic. And visualizing and visually are two of the two most important tools in our tool belt at Just3 and a lot of our clients. So I'm excited to turn it over to them. Thank you very much.
Hey everyone, my name is Tal Siach. I'm the co-founder and CMO of Visually. Great to be around with a great bunch of people here on the panelists. Love what you're showing, the interactive stuff, the video information that you did with ESPN. I mean, these things that we endorse and like in our community. So let me back it up a bit. So I will speak about how data visualization is changing communities. I will try to speak about why publishers and how exactly our community is embracing it, but also speaking about our new creation tool we just launched today, visual.ly/create, allowing people to create their own infographics to tell their own stories with the Twitter API and Facebook API and other APIs. So if you guys are on Twitter, on Facebook, you can create amazing infographics, and I will show you how. So let me start by saying what Visually is. We are a platform to share explore and create infographics. And we have this cool video that we did on our lunch that I would love to show you guys. I think we're good now, right? Yeah. Sorry about that. So it's not a secret that you see infographics, not a visualization all over the place. You see lots of blogs like Mashable, TechCrunch, VentureBeat, Fesco Design. Also a lot of like social media sites like Twitter, Facebook, also social bookmarking sites, Pinterest, Dix, Tumblr, everyone posting infographics and are really viral and everyone seeing it. And the way we see it, like there are a lot of reasons why obviously people like data visualization and infographics. And one of the reasons why changing these communities and the blogosphere in publishing more and more of this stuff is personally for me, for example, like I like to consume information in a visual way. It's easier for me to see something and a chart that explains something than to read a big article about a certain subject. So I think a visual component is part of it. Second thing that we see that like publishers that do post infographics and do data visualization as part of their content strategy are getting with a good data visualization piece 30 times more pages and engagement from their users. And another thing we've seen as well is that the publishers that do the change and promoting infographics on their site and doing some of this work tends to go on average 12% to those that didn't. So I would like to speak about our community as well and show you some numbers. So we're likely to have just as one of our big users on the site, amazing infographics that they showcase on our site. Right now we have 42,000 users. We have around 4,000 designers and 12,000 publishers, and we go all the time. We a lot of people submitting infographics, and whether if it's images or interactive videos like we've seen, or even information videos, sorry, or interactive visualizations that you can engage with them. We do all of these, and for us it's really important to try to showcase all this great work that is outside and to contribute as well. We also have publisher partners that are publishing our stuff, like Huffington Post, TechCrunch, and Mashable are a few to name. But basically what we see here from our side is that there is big movement in data visualization. I think Moritz talked about it before. You have people that like learn this stuff, knows what they do, like it's part of their education. And now it's like a lot of time we see like other infographics, some maybe not don't look as serious as others, and I think there is a big scale out there. There's a lot of good stuff, a lot of other stuff that probably less good for, to some people. And I think what we're trying to do in visually, at least, is we're trying to bridge this gap between the DataViz experts that knows data visualization really well and users that have a lot of data out there or companies that have their own data and want to visualize it. And one of the reasons for us to tackle this was obviously to open like our code of ethics, which was very important for us that the stuff that we create and the stuff that we promote in our staff pick will follow a certain code of ethics that we, people will not lie with data, will attribute the right sources, not use Wikipedia as a source, but using better sources. So this is something that we pushing a lot of our effort there to try to push our code ethics down, and hopefully other people will embrace it. Some people obviously already do that. And we got a lot of good pickup in the media about this code of ethics. And lastly, what we do, we have DataViz expert guys who are writing on our blog and trying to educate and tell what are the best practices in order to do data visualizations and how to help people to do that. So what I would like to quickly talk about now is that we talked about, we show what we do as well. We allow people to create infographics. And we released today in South by Southwest our first round of tools, first template, sorry, to create infographics based on Twitter and Facebook data. And I would love to kind of quickly show it because it just launched right now. So I will do it like on the slides, not live, because probably interconnection will be slow. So if you guys are going to visual.ly/create, by the way, probably a lot of traffic right now, so bear with us if it's a bit slow. I know the guys are keep adding servers as we speak, probably. So one of our themes, for example, is this Twitter template that we did for South by Southwest. When obviously I split it to two because, you know, infographics usually are long. What we do here, we allow to every account, every user that have a Twitter account, basically to authenticate with Twitter and just do a kind of showdown mode. And for this example, I took Homer Simpson versus Dunkin' Donuts. Thought it was a good fit. So what you see like how many followers each one of my, okay. So here you can see how many like following followers people have, what is the ratio. Then we show the engagement level at the bottom. Then we also calculate when they tweet. So if I put Pepsi versus Coke, I can see different behaviors, who's tweeting at this time, who's tweeting at that time. And basically we're trying to allow users to tell their own story. So we can put you against your friend or just like two brands against each other. And the way we did it is that we really wanted to create a tool that allows people to get infographics and build infographics. So we decided to start from like have a full infographic and slowly customize it, then to start from the charts level and later on try to build it up. We thought it will give our user a better value to start creating immediately. And with time, we will release more APIs, we'll give them more customization and more stuff. Another thing we released today is another Facebook Insights template. If you guys are admin on any Facebook page, you can easily authenticate on Facebook and just create an infographic. So this is the visually page. It gives you insights. Like I think the Facebook API is great, but I think like if the visuals are not that good, if you ask me. And what we're doing here is if you go through the flow of the graphic, you will be able to really understand better what exactly going in your Facebook page. And I'll show last one. We have around the. If you show another one afterwards. This is our Facebook personal infographic. I will wrap it up. So sorry. What you need to do is basically everyone have a lot of data in Facebook. What we're doing here, we partner with the great company Face.com, and also using the social graph of Facebook to create your own monster. So it knows if you have a birthday, if you have a, it looks on your pictures and seeing if you wear sunglasses, if you didn't wear sunglasses, if you have a beard or don't have a beard, then it shows you how many likes you got, who are your top friends, what is your best photo, what is the gender breakdown. So there's a lot of kind of nice insights about this presentation, if you're smiling or not in your pictures. So this is what we're trying to do now, just bringing some DataViz tools to the market for people to visualize their own data, and with time we will try to do more and more of this stuff. So,
yeah,
Thanks, Tal.
All right. I will try to be brief, so we do have a few minutes for Q&A. So I'm going to take this to a sort of society level. And just before I do, I kind of want to tackle it first from an enterprise perspective and then from a broader society at large perspective. So from an enterprise perspective at Seed, we're concerned with how to apply the best of scientific thinking to help institutions solve really big, complex problems. And data visualization is very much a tool in our toolbox. And so when we think about how do we rationalize the use of data visualization in solving a problem for a large Fortune 100 company or a government, these are sort of three things that I thought I would share just in terms of some of our internal metrics. The first is, you know, if you are layering data visualization on top of a big data kind of solution, are you really compelling new insights or new perspectives? So systemic perspective, for example, something that you couldn't be doing if you were just doing a statistical model, if you were just doing R, if you were just doing something like that. Are you actually exposing something new? Are you reducing the cognitive load? Are you exposing new insights? That's the first metric we look at. The second is can we put data in more hands within an organization? So can we take data out of the hands of just data analysts or people working on market research or things of that nature and integrate that data into a larger organization? And this way create more opportunities for kind of collaborative discovery. And finally, we heard a lot about communication, can we use data visualization to communicate complex issues or relationships that previously weren't communicated, and can we do that within a large organization? From a society standpoint, we launched Visualizing in 2010 to really break ground in how the web interacted with visualizations and how NGOs, governments, universities around the world could participate in this extraordinary tool that is data visualization. And today, we count more than 100 organizations around the world, some of the most important NGOs, the UN, the World Bank, and so on, and more than 60 universities around the world as partners, really trying to create the defining platform to connect open data to impact. So three things we've observed about the impact of data visualization, how it's starting to, now that we're a few years into this revolution, it is time. It's time to put some empiricism behind it and establish what's working. So these are three things that I want to share with you very specifically how we're seeing this take shape. The first is in forging a more anti-disciplinary education. And I'll show you some of the stuff we're doing there. The second is in empowering some new form of citizen engagement, some new form of democracy. And thirdly, which actually connects really nicely to how more it started. I've been thinking for the past year about this notion of a new overview effect, and I'll kind of wrap it up with that. So three quick things that I want to show you that we've been doing at Visualizing for the last year and a half. So the first is talking about anti-disciplinary education. So we launched a program called the Visualizing Marathon, and I want to show you a quick video and talk about it. And if we can get sound. Yep.
I came prepared. I got a yoga mat, a pillow, and there's a little blanket in the bag just so I can get a little bit of rest.
Your challenge for the next 24 hours is to take this data set and illuminate some interlinkages.
That's it. Good luck. 24 hours. Go.
he's going to make it so we can see. And then we have to dig into the data. There's a lot of stories here.
I'm Isha. I study at London College of Communication.
Sydney University.
Communication, University of China.
I'm Dubai in India.
I'm from South Korea.
From Belgium.
This is good because we all have very different views from all our different cultures, so that helps a lot to come up with new ideas.
It's almost like having many, many eyes looking at this huge amount of data. Because in the end, data visualization really needs a lot of creativity. And so the more eyes you have looking at it from all over the world, the more you've got a better chance to understand what the data has to tell us.
Agora a gente realmente conseguiu focar o que a gente vai colocar nos nossos gráficos. E já sabe o que a gente vai falar sobre os países que vai comparar com o Brasil.
Like, we're trying to figure out ways for them to be more sustainable. Then fishing, I feel like, is separate from education.
Not necessarily. Are they making it to seventh grade, or are they going
into fishing?
Convey that understanding to someone else.
There's so much information to deal with. We kind of have to figure out a way to break it down into, you know, usable chunks.
3 or 4 years ago, everyone was complaining, we don't have enough data to know what's happening. Now it's a fire hose. And we need to learn how to create visualizations that can actually help someone who doesn't have a technical background, but is trying to help people understand what's happening.
But anyway, so what we've seen across this program, I just came back from India. We ran this program for the first time in India last week, and across Brazil and Europe and the US, has been sort of the engagement of students in all forms of disciplines. So coming from computer science, from design, from studying biology, from studying economics, and visualization has become a language for them to come together from and start from first principles and tackling issues like sustainable development or fisheries or global health. In India, we were tackling the transition from the burden being on communicable diseases in India to non-communicable diseases like heart disease. And it was through data visualization, through this lens and through the toolbox of data visualization that these 100 students we were working with last week were able to extract new insights about this transformation in society and start to participate in some new way compelling some broader societal awareness for the issue. So I think what's been interesting through this experience of the marathons has been both this kind of anti-disciplinary education. We're working with schools around the world to think about how data visualization really helps us think systemically about problems in the world, and also this new form of citizen engagement that is compelling students themselves being a part of helping their fellow citizens. So when media picks up the visualizations happening through these marathons, how they themselves are helping their fellow citizens sort of act as journalists and help communicate these complex issues. The other thing I want to share with you is an experiment that we have ongoing right now called the Visualization Sprint. So this is a new concept, admittedly experimental, and it is inspired by both sort of the citizen science movement, where we've now democratized the tools of science and anybody can go and collect water samples, for example, from around the world. Initiatives like AMANO, which is a project in Latin America, where local communities are coming together and using data visualization to actually model out a local issue. So it might be biodiversity, for example, and actually start collecting data as individuals, as citizens, and then create very crude visualizations of this information. But then those visualizations start to turn back to the public and to the policymakers to impact policymaking. So we were inspired by these kinds of things, and UNESCO and the International Year of Chemistry came to us with a data set produced by 75,000 students in 80 countries around the world, measuring water quality and salinity and pH around the world. And we thought, instead of running a normal kind of visualization challenge, which we've been running on visualizing from day one with all sorts of great NGOs, we thought, could we create sort of some new form of collaborative data visualization, some sort of response from design to citizen science? And so we introduced this idea just a couple weeks ago, and we're really excited about it, and we would very much invite you to come and participate. It works, you know, it's inspired by kind of a GitHub-like format. You can go on, take an initial code that was started by a designer that we invited. You can fork it. You can work on any of the 42 versions that are already been contributed here, and find a new way of modeling, of visualizing this information. If you want to work and transform the data and contribute as a data scientist, we can do that as well. What we're trying to do is find a way of engaging the broader design community in responding to a social issue like this, where the citizen scientists are driving the data, but can design serve in responding to it and helping really find the best approach, the best solution through some collaborative versioning type process. In the interest of time, I will just briefly mention one other thing that we have underway. So similar in terms of society at large, this is a project that will be up March 22nd there in Times Square. So using measurements collected by the GRAY satellites over the last 10 years, looking at seasonal and long-term fluctuations in groundwater levels, we had our community visualize this data, and then the best visualization, as judged by our jury in this case, has been working for the last few months to put this work up in Times Square on World Water Day, presented by Visualizing, to transform the way New York and tourists to New York engage with this issue, again, through the lens of data visualization. And then finally, so I've been talking about this sort of new overview effect for a little while. This is for those of you who are familiar with the building, this is the Media Lab at MIT, and this is work from Joe Paradiso's lab, and it struck me as pretty fascinating because it's pretty standard. It's sensor data, right? You're looking at noise and motion and where people are clustering and things like that in the building. But it was sort of startling to me. It was compelling in seeing the whole thing as one. And I, too, have found kind of relevance in thinking about how astronauts have looked at the planet. And you heard Moritz talk about sort of as a designer seeing the whole system. So what it makes me think about is actually this quote from one of the Apollo astronauts, and I'll just leave it up there and you can read it. But this phenomenon of stepping outside a system and seeing it as a whole is called the overview effect. And what happened, so instead of just the overview effect itself is pretty fascinating, but what happened in the 1970s is that when we saw the fragility of the planet, when we stepped outside of it, the United States had led to the Silent Spring, it led to the birth of the EPA, it basically led to the birth of the environmental movement. So by having a new way of looking at our system and stepping outside of it, we gained this kind of social impetus and this basis upon which to start a major transformation in society. And so when I was just in India and showing them this and talking about this and engaging with students who are participating in this marathon, we started talking about, as students now who are not only participating in using the data from their society, so data that's measuring how their citizens are responding to certain health concerns, but now actually acting as visualizers of that information, because visualization itself has become democratized and they can start participating in the visualization of the information. But now they can start actually compelling new thinking about the issue itself and gain an economic, social, political perspective on something like non-communicable diseases and start maybe compelling some sort of new types of movements. And this is opportunity, I think, across society, and the question I would leave us with is what's this overview effect that we're now able to compel through data visualization going to instigate in our society? What's our EPA? What's our social movement that comes about not, in this case, from seeing the fragility of the planet, but from seeing how interconnected and systemic our problems actually are? Thanks.